Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Movie. This one is one of our prestige films in the prestige feed collection. It's Road to Perdition. It's a 2002 crime drama directed by Sam Mendes. You might recognize him as the director of American Beauty, as well as many others. I'm drawing a blank.
1917 is his most recent.
There you go. Yeah. 1917 that we liked quite a bit. Screenplays by David Self, who wrote The Haunting and 13 Days, which I actually really enjoyed. It's based on the graphic novel Road to Perdition by Max Allen Collins. And it stars Tom Hanks, Paul Newman, and one of his final in-person roles, Tyler Hoechlin. 14-year-old Tyler Hoechlin, who has now got everybody abuzz with his turn as Superman on the new Superman reboot on CW or... I don't know, Paramount TV, whatever the fuck. Jude Law, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Stanley, he's Gucci Tucci, Daniel Craig, and Ciarán Hinds. So this movie was dedicated to Conrad Hall, who was the cinematographer behind Cool Hand Luke, Butch Cassidy and a Sundance Kid, American Beauty, and as well as this film. And it was dedicated to him because he died shortly after. And won a posthumous Oscar for the cinematography in this film, which I'm going to be talking a lot about. So I've seen this movie before. This was one of like baby's first prestige films. I really like Tom. Like this is back in the day where like I really didn't see a lot of rated R movies, especially at the theater. But I really liked Tom Hanks. You know, I always enjoyed his work growing up. I loved him in Big. He had just done Castaway. You know, the PG-13 film that I was kind of allowed to watch just 2 years before. And him as a kind of bad guy gangster talked me into going and seeing this film. And it kind of really blew me away. And I have not seen it since I went to see it at the movie theater. So it's been about 20 years. What about you, Jim? What have you seen this movie before and what do you think of it?
No, I've never seen it before. This came out in, 2002. It's weird to me because I like what you said about it being kind of, you know, baby's first prestige film. It has that like 90s feel to me, like 90s prestige feel. And I don't know, it's got like a Spielberg feel to it. There's something like very high production, very like well made, but not very challenging about this movie. It's like, well, it's got the central theme of, you know, this, and we seem to be covering this a lot with the boxer last week, which is like this theme of violence passed down, right? And that's not a super challenging theme. It's nothing like Lighthouse or, I don't know, the shit that they're making today that you consider prestige is like, night and day compared to this stuff. So it's got like that veneer of 90s feel to it, even though it's made in the 2000s, which to me made it good but not great. And maybe if I had seen it back then, I would have been more blown away by it. I do agree that like seeing Tom Hanks as a bad guy, I can think of very few movies where that's the case. As a matter of fact, I'm drawing a blank right now. I can't think of any other movies where I've seen Tom Hanks play anything but kind of a wholesome guy pretty much all around. So that was different. That was enjoyable. And I always like seeing Paul Newman, and the performance he gives in this is fantastic.
He's nominated. I'm not sure if he won an Oscar for supporting.
He did not. No, he lost to Chris Cooper in Adaptation this year. But yeah, I thought, you know, it's a good movie. It has some small flaws, but not many. And everything else it's doing is done very competently, and it looks great, and it sounds great. This movie is technically really well executed.
Yeah, I think that's when you say that it has this kind of weird late 90s, early 2000s kind of prestige feels, because now like these things were big business. You know, like Lighthouse, you mentioned, I think had a budget under $4 million.
Right.
And it was just locking two dudes in a 10 by 10 room and having them throw a rager. This $80 million. And, you know, everything was just like, I read the making of this film, and there's some just bonkers shit in it. Like, You know, they wanted to get this certain shot of a lake house and they wanted it to seem a certain way. And they shot it in like a nature preserve on the shore of Lake Michigan. And there just happened to be like a 100-year-old foundation of a building left over. And they built a whole fucking house on that thing and shot the, you know, what, 5 minutes of film on it and then tore it down to leave it pristine.
Wow.
Sam Mendes, location scouting, found the perfect corner to stage a bank heist. But everything was going in the wrong direction. They needed to take a right hand turn instead of a left hand turn. And it didn't sit. So he had the set dressers go and reverse all the signage on the street. They had cars specially manufactured to reverse the steering wheel. And then they just shot it left to right and then flipped it. And it's like everything was like kind of like everything's kind of feels like it's assembled from the lab. Now, I think this paid off because I still think, you know, this film won an Oscar for its cinematography.
Yeah.
This guy is a, you know, Conrad Hall is a famed cinematographer. He's in the top 10 cinematographers in the International Cinematographer Association. And I was reading the way they got, like, I've really paid attention to lighting because I've seen stuff shot in pitch black where it's garbage.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it doesn't really help when you have modern, you know, streaming services compressing it and stuff like that. Yeah,
like Game of Thrones. That
I was trying not to bring that up. But like I've seen like things where you can just barely tell what's going on. And then you see something like the Better Call Saul, where they're really experimenting with new super high aperture cameras. And just what they're able to achieve where it looks like it's pitch black, but you can actually still see everything. And this stuff where it's shot pitch black conditions, but also in like downpouring rain. And yet everything still. So like I was looking, I could see the texture on the wool, this omnipresent wool coats that they're wearing. There's the water pouring off of it and stuff. And it's just like just beautiful. These inky black scenes of hallways. And yet everything's so crystal clear. And then another technique this guy used, I guess, in shots of broad, you know, daylight, you know, sunny scene, he would take black silk and drape it over the area they were filming. So it seemed like even in a bright, sunny day, the character, like Tom Hanks' character, looks like he's personally overcast, like there's a black cloud over him that I'd never really seen kind of techniques like that before. So it's like, yeah, this film might have been assembled in a lab. And it might lose a little bit of kind of the messiness that you see in maybe better gangster films like The Godfather, like Goodfellas, stuff like that. But it's still just like, you know, in every frame, a painting kind of way. It's just really beautiful. And, you know, we've for whatever reason watched a shit ton of gangster movies of late.
Mm-hmm.
I really like getting away from the Italian mafia and for once in a while, like these, this Irish mob, this like Great Depression, late stage prohibition era, you know, the everyone kind of dour and Midwestern. It's set in, I forget which island on the border of Iowa and Illinois it is, but like it's kind of Chicago adjacent Midwestern. Irish gangster, very kind of Fargo feel, like, you know, very reminiscent of the last season of Fargo, actually.
And I think all those locations help too, because like when you're shooting this thing, you have to think, okay, how are we going to dress these sets? And, you know, you could take all the signage down and replace it with reversed signs and get the perfect bank shot. Or you can just go to downtown Chicago where 90% of the buildings still look like they did the day that they were built. You get a lot of mileage just setting it in those locations, right?
Yeah, and they did. There's a very impressive shot of Tom Hanks and his son driving into Chicago where they shut down the main thoroughfare into Chicago. Got 140 really cool. Studebakers and Model Ts and all these other and, you know, spared no expense of doing that recreation. But yeah, I like seeing kind of like the and in the same way that it's interesting seeing. Like, you know, Italian American gangsters trying to like blend their heritages. They get into a little bit of that. It's never like the text, but it's subtext, you know, like you can see here the faintest bit of like the Irish accent on these guys. And I guess Newman, yeah, worked with a Irish American poet to get that kind of, because he's like, I like that you can just like the 10% Irish brogue that's still there. And he tried to emulate that, and you can tell.
And I think it's different in the generations too, right? Because I think he has maybe the most pronounced Irish accent in the entire movie, even though it is slight. And then Tom Hanks, if he's doing one, I can't tell. So
it's more of a, yeah, Tom Hanks accent's more of a, like a Midwestern Chicagoan accent. Yeah. And Daniel Craig, who does a fairly convincing American accent. I mean, he's kind of like, I mean, if you've seen him in what was it, Knives Out, like he's got the yeah, foghorn, leghorn. He's a man of a million American accents, apparently.
Sure.
And that's the other fun thing about this, seeing like all these people who, you know, there's like Tom Hanks and Paul Newman already. You know, Paul Newman's a legend. Tom Hanks is on his way.
Yeah.
Jude Law in some fairly early transition work for him. Jennifer Jason Leigh, which I haven't seen her in a lot of things, but she's got a small role in this. It's fun. Daniel Craig playing just like a lunatic, like a Sonny Corleone type of hothead is really fun.
And it's a few years before he would become Bond. And I didn't really know who Daniel Craig was until he became Bond. So seeing him in these earlier roles is always interesting. Just seeing, you know, because now I think of him as James Bond. I don't think of him as an actor so much as the character. So, seeing different gears that he has is pretty cool.
I think, and then the other thing is like the one theme you mentioned, like the violence, you know, running through families and whatnot as a theme. The father-son, you know, generational struggle, I thought was really poignant. And, you know, now that I'm a father, it's been 20 years since I've seen this film, like the father-son relationship of Tom Hanks and Tyler Hoechlin, maybe, it really hit. In fact, like I was very moved by the final 15 minutes of this film. I'd forgotten the ending too. I don't want to say much more because if there's, you know, this is nearing 20-year-old film, and I know a lot of people probably haven't seen it. And, you know, if you want to see Tom Hanks, Paul Newman, one of his last roles where he got an Oscar nomination, at least as a supporting actor. I think it's the only one I think I remember reading at some point that's the only Oscar he got nominated, not as a leading man.
Okay.
And he's very, very good in this film. Yeah. It's good. And like I said, the final act I thought was really good. There is one glaring flaw that I will definitely talk about. But yeah, if you haven't seen it, maybe now is the time to kind of like give you the basic outline of the movie. This is set, as we alluded to, in 1931, the winter of 1931, in kind of like a rural suburb of northern Illinois, set during the Great Depression, in the middle of a prohibition. You've got the Rooney family, who is this crime syndicate family that kind of rules the town. Paul Newman is the godfather of the family. Daniel Craig is the son, but he's also got like this Tom Hagen type of role going on at Tom Hanks, where he's, for whatever reason, this guy's a war hero from World War I, taken into the family. There's been a rivalry between him and Daniel Craig. They just sketch and suggest all this stuff. His son, who's kind of like the POV of this whole movie, is, you know, kind of idolizes his father, but doesn't have a good handle on him. And one night, smuggles himself in the trunk of the car to go along with one of his, what he thinks is his dad's missions. He thinks his dad's like a GI man or a secret servant agent or something, and sees a hit. And Daniel Craig's character, the younger Rooney, gets into his head that, you know, Tom Hanks and his son have to die as witnesses. The whole family has to. And that sets Tom Hanks's character, Mike, on a collision course. Mike Sullivan with a collision course with the Rooneys, and whole blood soaked film lies ahead. You mentioned it's interesting to see Tom Hanks as a heavy. And I remember thinking that, too. Like, I'd never seen him in something like this where he's just an unrepentant killer.
Yeah.
And then I read like how much sanitized this character was from like the graphic novel. Like the graphic novel, he's an alcoholic. The violence is even more wanton and widespread. He's much more of a like a brutal killer. Whereas this, it's like you get the idea that he's more of a professional soldier who is very loyal to a man who is a father to him and thinks that, you know, he's probably, this is illegal, but, you know, it's kind of business. They toned down a lot of the language and the violence from the comics too. So like, yes, this is Tom Hanks playing a bad guy, but he is still, you can tell, concerned about, like, I don't want to be that kind of guy.
That's interesting, because the whole conceit of this movie is you're supposed to ask yourself, is this a good guy or a bad guy, right? Like, then they bookend the movie with the kid saying essentially that. He was my father, right? And you can make your own judgments because he's not your father. That's weird to hear that it was a little more bad guy tinged in the comics. I wonder what made them go that direction with this movie then.
I guess it's Tom Hanks. He was like really adamant about, like, he wanted a certain, wanted to cut that. He wanted a violence to feel like it was always warranted, in contrast to like the Daniel Craig character, who is a loose cannon, in contrast to the Jude Law character, who is a psychopath. And I think about like Bruce Willis in this role, he would have just played the comic book character
for sure.
Cause Bruce, like, he plays mostly good guys, but he really doesn't give a shit about, you know, being, painting in dark, dark shades of gray. Like, I think about his work on Sin City and how hard boiled that was, but Tom Hanks still is like a little bit, you know, I might want to play Mr. Rogers in a few years. And I don't want,
what a concession, you know, to make to the lead actor, huh?
Well, you know, when you're paying $80 million out and Tom Hanks is probably a good 15% of that, you right. probably, you know, he probably gets a say in it.
Yeah.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
But yeah, they also, something that shocked me is like Tom Hanks is wearing a prosthetic nose.
You know, I thought I detected that during the movie.
It's very subtle.
It is, yeah. And I don't really understand why they would do that, because it is so subtle. And but I did notice it too, and I don't know if it had like some subliminal effect on me. I don't know what the purpose of the nose is.
It might have been, because I don't know, I actually looked into, like, see, because I found that fascinating. I was trying to find out more about the nose, and I was going and looking at production stills of the film versus, because, like, Tom, you know, dudes, our ears and nose get bigger throughout our life, it seems.
Sure.
I don't know what it is, but, like, yeah, it's just, like, you know, whatever proportions God gave you get cartoonish as you get older. And, like, Tom's nose 20 years now is a little bit kind of Mike Sullivan-ish. But I had to go all back right. and look at 2003, like, Tom Hanks just at award shows versus this. And it seems like they've just slightly thickened, like, the bridge to suggest that maybe he got his nose broke a time or two.
Huh.
But I wonder okay. if clearly Tom Hanks was a little uncomfortable, like he was drawn to the role because of the father-son relationship. He's uncomfortable at the role with some of the language and violence. I wonder if this was like his magic feather. It's like when he looks himself in a mirror, it's like, oh, yeah, this ain't Tommy no more. This right. is Mike. Mikey's a bad man. He's going to go out there with his Tommy gun and he's going to rat-a-tat-tat. I wonder if it was just that, like. It puts a level of remove from himself in the role.
And what, like putting an artificial scar on him would have been too much signaling that he's a bad guy. I just wanted to notice.
Speaking of character altering makeup.
Mm.
The only problem I have in this film is how they made up Jude Law.
Why is this a problem? Well, okay, first of all, describe what they did to him for people who haven't seen this.
So Jude Law plays like a kind of a nightcrawler type crime scene photographer, yeah. where he starts long ago before this film starts blurring the line between, you know, you get the idea that maybe some half of these crime scenes he films, he caused.
Sure.
And they decide to portray this character because so Jude Law's, I don't know if you know this, but he's a very good looking man.
Sure.
They take his already receding hairline and they thin it. So he looks like he's balding. Yeah. They give him a dental appliance that makes his teeth look nubby mm-hmm. and very stained and yellow, like he doesn't take care of them. He's wearing what I could only describe as Nosferatu fingernails.
Yeah, they're like clearly like press-on Halloween store fingernails.
They're long, they're unkempt, the cuticles yeah. are inflamed and infected, his hands dirty. Are dirty and tobacco stained. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand, like this is very much like my Contagion problem, you know, where he plays this conspiracy theory kook. But they give him a dead tooth and fucked up teeth and some, you know, they dress him all schlubby. And it's like, would this character not work better if he was more superficially, like Jude Law is charming. So have him be the charming psychopath. Like, why does he have to literally be this devolved, like monstrous state? I just feel like every scene that he's in would have worked better if he looked just like Jude Law.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, I don't know. It must be obviously related to the comics and that character in there. I haven't read the comic, but I assume
no, he's
it's
not.
Because of his
profession. This character is invented for the screenplay. He is not in the
seriously?
Comic. That's wow. Two things blew my mind before you speculate.
Yeah.
One, Jude Law hated this look. And he felt very self-conscious about it. And like every time sure. the, like apparently set report said every time the action was cut, he had a beanie that would put on his head because he's so self-conscious about how gross he looked.
Oh, that's weird,
and,
man. He's an actor.
And this character was invented for the film. So it's like, you've got this guy. I mean, why do you hire? Why? I mean, every once in a while, what's the Charlize Theron? You know, she wears sure. heavily makeup to play the monster serial character, Eileen Wuornos. I don't mind like when actors do kind of that, but like I feel like it's always with Jude Law, it's a halfway committal, you mm-hmm. know, like nothing in his performance ever kind of changes. He doesn't like act like a super creep, you know. In fact, he's kind of like superficially charming in some of the scenes, like at the diner initially. And I just feel like all that stuff would work better if he was just handsome Jude Law, but he's also a psychopath. Huh. Like,
see, I didn't think his behavior in the diner was charming or charismatic at all. I thought it was creepy.
Well, it got there. Okay. But that's okay. That's where it, you know, that's where that's why it would work better if he was unhinged only in his behavior and his affect, not in his appearance.
Sure. People could be taken in by him initially and then turned off by him once they get to know him. He's great. Like, I don't know what it does change my perspective on Jude Law a little bit to know that he's so self-conscious about this, because like, he's a very good looking man. You don't stay that good looking for as long as he has without being very concerned about your looks. So I understand.
Oh, you gotta work at it. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He clearly works at it, but like, to not, I don't know, I would think there would be a separation between the role, the character, and the actor, especially on a movie set, which to hear that, you know, he's self-conscious about it in that time and place is weird to me.
I just think it's just a weird call for like this character, like everything to be so extreme. If you want him to have like, because he's supposed to be pale and sallow because he's always in a dark room. And if you want his hands to be like stained and chemical burnt because he's always dealing with harsh, like stuff that makes sense. But like, what about this guy that he just doesn't care about his physical appearance at all? Don't know that. There's another, I note that they said that they wanted, that Sam Mendes was concerned with, you know, Jude Law being the primary antagonist to Tom Hanks, who he described as physically imposing. There's a lot of adjectives I could describe Tom Hanks. Physically imposing is not one of it. He pulls it off in this film.
Sure.
With the help of like ginormous wool coats and big hats and things like that. But like, Tom Hanks is like a hulking bruiser. I don't associate that.
No.
But like, I don't know. Like, he wanted him to like, I guess, to look very feral and dangerous and that, which I don't know. Again, I thought it was a bad call. It's very distracting. Every single frame he's in, I just can't help noticing how they've hideoused up Jude Law.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, like, they're trying to do something with his profession and his looks and tying those together. Which I guess makes a certain amount of sense. And I didn't have a huge problem with it. I think a different actor might have been more comfortable in that skin, though. Although I do like his performance, because I imagine like you put these fingernails and this hair and these teeth on Bryan Cranston and he's just going to be hamming it up offset. Right. Like freaking people out. You know, passing people their craft services dish with these fingernails half tucked into their biscuits or something, like
touching all the donuts. With
right.
This.
Right.
Oh, like, which one am I going to eat today?
Yeah, it seems a little bit kind of stick up your ass not to have some fun with this because you look so weird. But his performance in this movie, I thought was really good. Like the way he comes across as trying to act, you know, charismatic and suave in this diner. He's talking to this waitress and clearly, you know, she's cool. He's trying to play it cool. But also he's almost trying to give away some hint of like, I'm after you in this scene to Tom Hanks, to Mike. It's played very on the edge there. And he's played like he's hunched down. He's like physically kind of changing himself into this strange sort of creepy character. And I think, you know, that's what makes him such a good actor, is he's able to, with his performance, tell us so much about this weird guy.
Yeah, that's why that scene where he's flirting with the waitress and she's kind of like receptive to it. Like, I think that this guy looks like such a weirdo and he probably smells like hell. And like, I felt like that the waitress should have been a little bit more put off by him. And it's like she's playing to Jude Law, not to the character. Whereas if it's just Jude Law and he's a secret creep, it would also be, you know, because like, I think this is, it's a great set. It's a great scene. It's well written. The set is amazing. There's a lot of tension here. The single drop of Tom Hanks sweat that begins to roll down is like a very nice touch. But I feel like everything works better if it's just Jude Law, this polite, kind of urbane, charming looking guy that you in a 3-minute conversation start to realize is a danger to you. because, like, okay, you know, Mike Sullivan sees this guy sit down, and I think his, like, radar bells almost to the point where, yeah, I thought it was ridiculous that Jude Law even went into the diner,
mm-hmm,
and, like, sat down. It's like, are you trying to blow the job or what? You know, because everything else works great. You got the cop there, you know, like, what's, you know, that's like a little pressure cooker situation. You got Tom Hanks, who has left his son in the car because his son's being a little bit of a snit. So he's vulnerable because he can't just, you know, worry about himself. He's got to worry about his kid and what he's out there doing. It just, everything is kind of let down a little bit by Jude Law rolling in there like a creepy crawly.
All right. Yeah, I didn't feel that. I do have one complaint. We'll talk about all the stuff we love about this movie because there's a lot of it. My only real complaint about this movie is when they get to the part of the movie where Tom Hanks has robbed a bunch of the banks of the Capone money, and he's hit the dead end where Capone has taken all his money out of the banks, and so he's got to go see the accountant, Rance. There are a lot of coincidences here. Like, what is it? McGuire? Is that Jude Law's character's name? Yes. Staking out the hotel room of Rance. And I don't know why he's doing that. Like, he has lost a trail of Mike Sullivan, but he...
Wait, he's, isn't that...
Huh?
Hmm. You know, I thought that was the same hotel they're keeping Daniel Craig in. Like, that's just like Capone, like one of the Capone satellite operations. And it just so happened that he... It's kind of like the Terminator is likely, you know, like, what is Mike? Why is Mike hanging around and in hiding? Because he wants to kill Daniel Craig. So he's watching Dan. But, like, well, I just realized Connor, I think that's completely Chicago wrong.
Yeah, he's up.
No,
with,
you're absolutely
with
right.
Nitty.
You're at, but Nitty is in Chicago. Uh-huh. He drove all the way to Chicago. So it's like they are in the same place, but I don't think they're in they're in the same building at all. I think I just completely missed that. So
I don't think
you're
so.
Right.
I don't know why he's staking out Rance to catch him. And then there's this series of coincidences, and I don't know if it's played for comedy here or what, but, like, you know, he walks in, Rance has been complaining about this eggs Benedict or whatever the hell, this this runny
egg,
this egg he wants runny but isn't runny, and the hotel attendant downstairs is trying to get the order right, and he's, like, turned around right as Hanks walks in and past him and up the stairs, and, like, there's just a series of coincidences that happen in that scenario and that moment that make me go, eh, I wish this was, it's tightly scripted, but I wish it were more believable, I guess.
Huh.
In a movie that otherwise is almost completely grounded and believable.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about how efficient the script is, but, like, I didn't notice the leap in logic about, like, why all the main characters were at this particular hotel. I thought it just made, like, it was kind of like Jude Law was there on the lookout for him trying to reacquire Daniel Craig, but because, like, past that scene is just, I think, one of the greatest scenes in the film as far as tension.
Yeah,
because you got the ticker tape kicking on because, you know, the Wall Street bell is open.
It's so many coincidences stacked. The kid misses it because he looks down. He misses Jude Law coming in because he looks down right as Jude Law walks past.
But that's what builds the tension. And he tries to horn his dad, and Jude Law's heading across with a shotgun, and, you know, like, I felt
it does,
like,
build tension, but it just felt a little too cute to me, a little too perfectly timed.
Okay. What else do we, I want to talk about the, how great this show is at setting up characters in, like, the first 10 minutes, you watch this kid and he's hanging out with his dad. He shoplifts from a guy who he knows, that he's not just like some random, you're not just stealing from like some random cashier at Walmart. Like, he knows this man's name, the store.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, his dad sternly warns them they're going to Wake. He doesn't want to see those dice. The way that Mendez films Tom Hanks in the first act of the film, where they make it very clear that, you know, Junior doesn't really know his dad. He thinks he's some kind of secret agent guy that helps this very important political figure in town, even does missions for the president. And but he doesn't really know. And his younger brother kneeling him on that kind of, like, goads him into action. But they kind of give this, like, you see this kid who's, like, you know, he's a decent kid, but he's kind of, like, going down a certain path. And the way they set up, you know, Paul Newman as this kind of great figure hosting this Wake for another important, and, you know, everything looks just so, and then Ciarán Hinds gives up to give that speech, and then it kind of goes sideways, like, oh, there's trouble in paradise. There's some kind of, you know, they introduce Daniel Craig, who's got this perpetual smirk on his face, and he's got this great line when a kid asks him, why are you smiling? He's like, because it's just so fucking hysterical. Little bit of a Joker character. Like, everything is just so effortless and so little dialogue. I read that there's only 6 lines of dialogue in the final 20 minutes of this film. And the way they do, like, with the Paul Newman character, how he's like one of those, you know, Vito Corleone kind of good gangsters. There's an early scene of him with his lieutenants negotiating about how they're going to handle a union strike. And he's like, you know, we screw these guys. We make our money off of what these guys do in their free time. We're not going to screw him at work.
Yeah.
Like, kind of like he's this principled guy, but still a murderer. You know, I just thought it's like amazing how efficiently they set all this stage.
For sure. And they do a lot of sort of subtle work, too. I get the vibe coming into this wake that this is a crime family, but the kids don't really know that, right? This life seems normal to the kids. It's just their life. And you know, they think of their dad in a certain way, but they don't really know anything about their dad. It doesn't do anything specific to really set that up. It just gives you that vibe where, like, maybe a couple of characters are talking in a hushed tone about a thing that you don't know what it is, but you know that something is up. And the kids are like oblivious and ignoring it and out on the dance floor or something, right? It's just really well constructed to give you a feeling of something wrong. And I think that puts you in the kids' headspace because it's all seen through the kids' lens, right? Mike Sullivan Jr. is kind of the narrator and the POV of this entire movie. And that gives you the space to sort of identify with that character.
Yeah, I feel like a full 2/3 of this film is explicitly, literally, the camera is this kid's POV. And that's why what you're trying to, I think, put your finger on is, like, Sam Mendes did a very deliberate technique of, like, the first act of this film, when you got the POV from the kid, like, you never see Tom Hanks as an entirety. You see him through the crack of a door. You see his hand, you know, cleaning a weapon and putting into a suitcase. You see him through a slit and a crack, or see it through the rumble seat of a car. Mm-hmm. And when his son then sees him ventilate a whole room full of people and is discovered, then you see the kid see his father in full. And from that point forward, the movie is saying that, like, this kid doesn't know anything and he's got, like, all these questions about his father, and they get to know each other for the first time in this very extreme circumstance. And, like, all that stuff works really well because it's as much visual storytelling as it is, you know, anything in the script.
And the stuff they do with this book that the kid is reading, I think, is really good, too. It's sort of like serves as a recontextualizing anchor for this kid, because he looks at this page in the book and he sees this robber in a mask, right, doing some bad deed. And when he tells his brother about the missions that his father goes on, he's presuming, I think, that his father goes on missions to stop these guys.
Yeah, and guys with guns aren't necessarily bad. No.
Sure. Yeah.
The Lone Ranger. Lone Ranger's a good guy. His dad's a war hero.
Right. You got to fight the guys with guns with your own guns, right? And so he thinks his dad is this good guy out hunting these robbers. Now, over the course of the movie, he recontextualizes that. And every time he looks at this book and this particular page that he flips to with his image on it, he's got to rethink his assessment of where his dad is, or how this image lines up with his father. Is his father the robber? Is his father the cop trying to catch the robber? Is his father neither of those and is just his father? By the end of the movie, I think that's where the kid lands. You know, he can't judge his father too much. He's seen the good and the bad. So,
since this is the first time you saw this film, did the twists work? Because I remember, again, I was pretty naive when I watched this, but being, like, blown away that Daniel Craig had, like, double crossed, had the temerity. Because, like, you know, I took things a lot more at their face value back then. So when I got the head of the crime boss saying, you know, he wants this done a certain way and he wants this to happen, I'd like, well, it's just no way Daniel Craig is going to, like, brook him. You know, I hadn't seen like a million other films since then, including John Wick, where that's just a stock and trade. The younger, yeah, hot-headed. He didn't earn the position. He's just, it's,
yeah,
problem. Yeah. Problem with any kind of hereditary leadership system. Mm-hmm. But like that scene at the speakeasy, was that actually, because like when I watched it back, I don't know if because I knew it was coming. But like, it seemed very belabored. Like, this is such an efficient script, but they stay on this like guy reading this note. And, you know, the fact that Daniel Craig came up and said, oh yeah, there's this last minute collection you need to make at this particular guy who's known to be trouble. And like, it seemed like there was like almost neon lights, like, you know, Mike Sullivan, you're about to be betrayed. And it wasn't nearly as shocking, you know, Tom Hanks whipping that gun out and blowing two guys' brains out. Did it work? Or
it worked for me. Yeah. I didn't really see that eventuality coming. I did see the Jude Law showing up at the end to kill Mike coming a mile away.
Boy, that's another one that killed me, because I thought when I first saw this movie, these are the way these movies go. It looks bad. You know, there's a lot of danger, but, you know, Tom Hanks is and this guy are going to this kid are going to be OK. They've won. They did everything. And when Tom Hanks comes back, there's this great scene of the kid like in his hotel room sitting on the edge of the bed waiting. And you know, you hear these steps coming up, and you can tell the kid's like scared to death. Like, is my dad going to come back, or is this, you know, has he been killed? And these are the guys, and it's his father, of course. And they hug, and then they go to the lake house. And I remember just being completely shocked when, you know, the blood just erupts from Tom Hanks' chest looking at that window.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, I should have seen the note thing coming, like every time, because I see this in Italian gangster movies all the time. You know, hey, we got a surprise meeting. We need you to come out here. We're gonna make you a
made man.
We got a shot
for mattresses.
You know?
We got a shot for mattresses, Polly. We got
we're gonna make you. It's finally happened. You've earned it. Here, come on out to this location. Then you get your head blown off. Now that you mentioned it, I should have seen that coming, but I did not.
We try to make it super easy to support Making Podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
The other thing I love about anytime Tom Hanks is in a movie, we talked about this in Catch Me If You Can. We're doing a little bit of a Tom Hanks series here. But like, he's very funny. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of this stuff with his son, like his son negotiating for his crime pay and like him leaping at the first offer. And he's like, could I add more? He's like, you'll never know.
Yeah.
And like teaching him how to drive and like the him being his getaway driver is hilarious. Mm-hmm. Like him like trying to and Tom Hanks like deadpanning. Hey, you know, there's no rush here. Just robbing a bank. Right. I thought was just really funny. And then he's also able to carry these poignant scenes like, you know, like late in the movie, they're finally talking. They're at this elderly couple's house, which is a little bit neat, too. Now that I think about it, like apparently this old man knows how to pull a bullet. And I don't know. He's a veterinary. He's like a Herschel type from The Walking Dead. He can patch you up, but don't ask too many questions. I did think, what are the odds that Al Capone comes and ventilates his whole family when he finds out, like, you know, it's like, there's this old farmer in the suburbs. Suddenly they got telling, you know, they're losing their house in the Great Depression. Suddenly they're flashing out with paint and he's got a new Studebaker. And I don't know. But like they have this conversation about like, did you like Peter? You know, there's this and this poor fucking kid so traumatized. He goes from being extremely sheltered to seeing his dad whack a whole room full of gangsters to seeing his mom and his younger brother get killed in their house. And he's like, did you like Peter more than me? And Tom Hanks explaining that, like, no, it's just that, like, I never worried about Peter because he was a certain type of kid and you were like me, which and I, you know, like I said, we talked about like whether this kid was good, bad, what I think he's just a kid actor. But like the. There's something there that kind of like pride and kind of relief and, you know, that like, oh, the reason that this dad was always hard on me is because he was afraid that I'd end up just like him. And his kind of realized without like Tom, I think he never articulates this, but like, you know, by the end of the movie, he's narrating that like my father's bit. The only thing my father is afraid of is that I would walk down the same road to perdition, you know. That he did. And I, like I said, I thought all that father son stuff really hit me in the heart.
There's a little bit of a thematic tie in with the families here. Right. And the kids and the fathers and the sons, because Connor is also in that scenario of being one of two children. One, you know, he's the only like biological child of Rooney. But Tom Hanks is like a adopted child of Rooney. And so there's this competition between them and you can feel that tension throughout the movie, right? Connor is definitely jealous of the relationship that Mike has with his father. And I think that's what causes him to actually go and kill his family is not necessarily the this kid's going to talk and we got to silence his family, but there's jealousy there for sure.
Obviously. Yeah.
It's tough because like Peter isn't a fuck up, right? He's probably too young to be a fuck up yet, but you get the impression that Connor is a fuck up in a lot of ways, right? He's a hothead. He's stealing from his father and from the organization. Whereas Mike is kind of the model son here, following in the footsteps of Rooney. And there's a thematic thing they're doing there that I can't quite put words to, but that works really well.
I think it works. It's got such a great redistribution of like narrative energy because like Tom Hanks and his son, the fear is that, oh God, this boy is going to turn out just like me. Mm-hmm. With Paul Newman and Daniel Craig, it's, oh God, this son is nothing like me, but he has to be.
Sure.
And then there's the, you know, also the real brutal, like third act betrayal is the fact that like Paul Newman knows that his son is doing this and betraying him. And he knows that Michael is the better son, but he's not his real son. And he's going back his blood.
Yeah.
And like that just kind of like cold evaluation of like where Mike stands in the world. I thought was like, it's just like interesting kind of interlocking story about like fathers and sons and, you know, intergenerational conflict and like how each relationship's kind of a mirror and like, but an inverted mirror of each other. I thought was just really good. And like you said, I didn't get this, but yeah. Cause I thought it's like, well, this is just Daniel Craig's character being a fuck up, but like, you're right. I think he forced a situation to killing Mike's family just to get revenge over him. And probably forced put his father in a situation.
That excuse, like, of we gotta silence this kid, right?
Right. And I knew you wouldn't go along with the dad because you're too soft, and like and forcing this conflict with Mike so that his father would have to disown him and do all that kind of stuff. And but he's also just deeply stupid. Like you can tell, like when he's delivering these threats to Stanley Tucci. You know, he's like, "Yeah, my father's old and I'm going to be the man." And like Tucci looks at him is like, "I'm Al Capone's like right hand man. And you're a fucking your dad is like a couple rungs below me. I'm doing this as a favor. And you're in here acting like you're going to."
And the only thing keeping Connor alive at this point is his father being alive. Right. The future is dead once he's dead. They're going to kill him. So,
but he doesn't think that. He thinks like this is entitled John Wick, that, you know, this is Theon Greyjoy thinking that he's the greatest because he's born on third base, that he hit a triple and is ready to slide into home. Doesn't see that the second his father dies, the first business decision he makes is going to royally piss off everyone in chain of command. He's going to get rubbed out.
Oh, I think they're waiting. I don't think he has to make any decisions. I think as soon as the father is dead, the son is dead here. He's been stealing from the organization, and they know it.
Right.
So
they'll quickly figure that out. What? Yeah. So
I mean,
the
records he takes from the accountant.
I thought his father was successfully protecting him.
Oh.
Because his father knew, like those looked like legit. Those look like legit transfers from like his lieutenants into his account, but they're going to his son, and like that would like why I don't think they're stealing for Capone. They're stealing from, but like obviously when his dad dies, he's not going to be able. But I don't know.
He's gonna because be again, like soon.
That's the thing is like this film doesn't really hold your hand, and a lot of you just have to like you have to kind of remember that Siren Hand's name. Was like this when you recognize it on the deposit slips because Mike just puts two and two together and the film trusts you're going to do it too.
Which apparently I didn't completely. So, okay.
But you got, I mean, you got, I think, enough to understand. And again, I've seen this movie a couple times. So,
yeah.
There's a great man. Paul Newman is such a monster.
Dude, yeah.
That scene where he like hammer punches like James T. Kirk versus the Gorn style hammer punches Daniel Craig to the ground. And it's like, I curse like,
the day. Yeah,
you can see this coming out of like speaking of Star Trek, Bill Shatner's mouth. And it's just scenery chewing.
Yeah.
But it feels so fucking organic when he's just like his father exasperated, like especially since later on, you realize that he knows the whole time his son's betraying him.
Yeah.
And like this like is extra, like, you know, it's like, God, you know, you stole from me and you did this and you did that and I overlooked at it, but now look what you've done. This actually is a lot reminiscent of John Wick, you know, the father figure and the betrayal and the famed mercenary and
the Ian,
but yeah, like stuff, him just beating Daniel Craig down to the ground and Daniel Craig cringing like a dog, like that was a great scene.
And the other scene I really love with Paul Newman and his performance is the apology scene where he's got all his lieutenants or whatever around this table. And Daniel Craig comes in after, you know, shooting Finn and has to apologize. And he does this half-assed apology. And Paul Newman says, "No, try it again." Does a half-assed again. He slams the table and says, "Apologize." Mm-hmm. And, you know, he gets up all sheepishly. It's a great scene. And the performance there is just perfect.
And like I said, it's a gut punch there in the basement of the church where, like, you know, Mike comes to the old man thinking that he's going to, like, the old man, the scales are going to fall from his eyes. Like, "Oh, my God, I've been duped this whole time." And then he finds out, "No, I knew that all along and I've already made the decision. I'm backing my boy over you."
Yeah. And then the
guy
is cast from there.
It's funny because like that's why I thought it was so interesting about the cinematographer, Conrad Hall. This was both of their last. I think Paul Newman went on to, of course, do voice acting. He was the old racing car in the movie Cars, the Pixar movie Cars. He I think voiced Magnificent Desolation, the Tom Hanks like moon OmniMax kind of documentary. He did a lot of voiceover work, but this is kind of his last feature film on-screen performance, and it was the last thing that Conrad Hall shot, and they got their start together. Well, I think obviously Newman been other stuff, but like Cool Hand Luke you know,
okay,
just like lifetime of working together in this final project.
I thought
that was neat little bookend.
We'll have to do some more Paul Newman movies because he's got a lot of stuff that I like. We gotta definitely talk about The Verdict at some point. Here on
Verdict's
Prestige.
Great. Have you seen Cool Hand Luke?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's good.
Okay, because like, yeah, there's a whole bunch of his catalog that I have not seen.
Yeah, me too.
Like, you know, until you made me watch what was that movie about the pool?
Oh, The Hustler.
Paul?
Yeah.
The Hustler. Oh my god.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah,
Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Never, you know,
yeah,
haven't
seen
Sting.
That one. I mean, holy shit. He's in so many good movies. Slapshot is a great one that we'll probably never cover because it's mostly a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like Paul Newman's catalog.
Yeah, controversial opinion.
I know.
Paul Newman, pretty good actor.
Pretty good.
Seemingly great guy. Yeah, yeah. had a couple goodies in
you
his
know
career.
What? I like his salsa too.
I like his dressings. They're pretty
All
good.
Right, yeah,
Newman's own. You got anything else to say about Road to Perdition?
I don't think so. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. If you haven't seen it, give it a shot. It's under 2 hours. It feels pretty breezy. It occasionally gives you like exactly what you want. I was worried that this was going to just be some meditation on, I don't know, the life of a gangster as relates to his son just entirely. And there was not going to be any action. But once they started robbing the banks, I was like, fuck yeah, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me a lot of things I didn't think the movie was going to give me. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, it really threads that needle between being like thoughtful and deliberative, but also have that punctuation of like action and comedy, but without it becoming like plodding or slow.
For sure.
So I think it's great, especially it's one of those not Italian mafia gangster movies that are kind of few and far between. So it's a different flavor of gangster film, and I enjoyed revisiting it. It's a good film. So that's our thoughts on Road to Perdition. Please stay tuned. We're recording this one in advance. We're trying to get ahead of the Prestige schedule, and we're having a couple of films that are like kind of, you know, timeless. We can release them at any time we want in case we have a gap in the schedule. So I have no idea what's going to be happening next week, but there will be something in the Prestige feed that will be prestigious, be a movie or a television, and you'll catch us there. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.